This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Mira Sivasudi. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food. And of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad with Julian and Ibrahim with the top business stories of the day. We start with Sona. Now, Sona Petroleum is an oil and gas SPAC. It adjourned its EGM yesterday after questions were raised over a capital repayment issue. This was in relation to proposed acquisition of a qualifying asset called Stag Oilfield, located off the coast of Western Australia.
They're also qualifying the return of capital, right? Only if you vote for that acquisition will you get back the money, which is equivalent to about a 15% dividend. In a report to Bursa Malaysia, they call this a reward to the shareholders. I don't think it's a reward. The money is already owned by shareholders, but at least they have this proposal on the table for shareholders. And I think that this is, I guess, a comforting factor for the shareholders.
And the reason why they say that the EGM is going to be postponed is because of the fact that some of the shareholders are unclear of these kind of 80 million ringgit worth of cost savings. And this is exactly why they need more time to understand more about the capital repayment.
So, but this demand for postponement came not from the shareholders. Right, it came from the company, right? So it'd be like something akin, is it, I'm asking a question here, voters being told by the government of the day, we're going to postpone the elections because you don't quite understand the issues facing the government at this point in time.
I don't know if it's quite like that. I think the company really wants the shareholders to understand the terms of the capital repayment. And I think... was on a grill recently, right?
Yeah, Ibrahim? That's right. The Vice President of Business Development for Sona Petroleum, Dato' Sri Saw Chew Boon, was on the breakfast grill, and I was asking him in specifics whether or not this is going to be beneficial for the company.
We are keeping our fingers crossed. I would like to assure shareholders that this is a good investment. Please look at our website. We have provided all the data there. Please look at it. I hope you are convinced and all of you will vote for the acquisition.
Now, that was Dato' Sri Saw Chew Boon, the VP of Business Development for Sona Petroleum. That was in relation to the QA, the Stag oil field in Australia. But that was not about the capital repayment that the investors are now asking what it means to them, the kind of implications that it entails. And this is exactly why they are looking for that postponement on the EGM.
Well, there is at least somebody, one person who, or one institution that understands the whole thing, and that is Credit Suisse. They have accumulated a 12% stake in Sona Petroleum. And not only that, they're also making big bets in another SPAC, which is Click Energy, a 7% stake there. So the idea behind this kind of bet is that they hope to get back the money in the trust account should the QAs be rejected, and they stand to make a very short-term dividend gains from this kind of bets.
Right, for non-specialists, the SPAC is probably one of those creatures they haven't encountered yet. I mean, in the past we had unicorns, today we have SPACs.
The unicorns are still around.
Yeah, so very quickly, what's the definition of a SPAC?
Special Purpose Acquisition Company. These are companies that are set up solely for the purpose of making investing decisions, and the fund managers behind them are industry people who know the industry. So, for example, a lot of these oil and gas SPACs are helmed by people of the industry who are supposedly very knowledgeable in making such decisions. But I think given that the oil price has caused a lot of trouble in the sector, the oil price crash has complicated acquisition decisions. And here, this is where we are right now.
Right, Meaty Minister Mustafa Mohamad says that Malaysia is growing from strength to strength as a leader in global halal industry. The Malaysia's or our halal industry has more than doubled since 2012 to over 10 billion ringgit last year. Question is, what edge do we have? Couldn't anybody get into this business and you know, beat us at it?
I think the core issue with halal is on certification. And I think Malaysia is a leading hub for offering the best certification there is in halal. That's coming from JAKIM. But of course, this is also a story where anybody can become a halal producer or halal manufacturer. And whether or not the right certification bears any bearing towards the products that they carry.
So I'm curious, Ibrahim, you're Muslim and I suppose you're a traveler as well. Is this important to you that every establishment, eating establishment that you go into has to have a halal certification?
Yeah, so this is a personal consumption matter, right? What matters to me may not necessarily matter to the rest of the industry. But if you ask me that question, which you did, ironically enough, it doesn't really matter to me when I'm traveling, as long as it gives me the right implication, or the right recommendation or the right perception that the place is of halal quality, I would still frequent the place and I would still consume in that place.
Right, so it's not, and it's not merely about food, right? I mean, halal, like the label, eco-friendly
ethical products.
Ethical products, they can be applied to a whole range of services and products, right? We had in this country quite a robust discussion about restaurants and whether certification was needed. There were restaurants, and especially in Eastern Malaysia or East Malaysia, where they were saying that even though you supplied alcohol to some customers, the fact that they was pork-free was sufficient for some regular customers, Muslim customers. For them, that was halal.
This is the thing about halal. What matters to consumer varies on a case-by-case basis. So that instance where you brought in the story of seafood places, it could be deemed as a halal institution, but you may not necessarily get that certification that I was speaking of earlier. But that proves a point where not any country can just have an edge over the other. Just because Malaysia is a Muslim country doesn't mean that Malaysia will be the primary or predominant halal country there is. Thailand, for instance, not a Muslim country, but they're going big on the halal business.
Yeah, I think that is a case of whether this is representative of the majority of Muslims in the world when they go traveling, and they are a big chunk of travelers around the world these days. More and more countries are taking note of the demands of the Muslim, this is really the question of whether the halal certifications are relevant. And we also have the other news today, which is on IOI having been suspended from their RSPO certification, and they are expected to lose a few customers from that.
Yeah. That's right.
I think with certification, it's always a question of the integrity of those institutions, right? We had a big scandal in Indonesia over halal certification. The idea there were, you know, bribes being paid and there was kickback and such. So that's probably put a taint on, you know, their certification processes. So again, certification, trust, all these things are very, very important.
So the question is whether the certification represents you, your personal belief. At least in the case of IOI, it did, because it has become a big thing among the investing community.
Mm-hmm.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Right. I think, tobacco companies are not the only ones feeling the pinch on higher excise duties. Breweries are also finding them hard to swallow as they bite into profit margins at a time when consumers are tightening their purse strings. Now, how are breweries dealing with higher excise duties? Are they passing it on to consumers?
Well, just as a background into this, the government has imposed a new tax on these brewery companies. Now they're going to tax the alcohol companies according to the percentage of alcohol. I guess this is in addition to previously the volume of alcohol. So some analysts think that this would actually result in about 8-10% hike for beers and about 5% with about 5% alcohol. I think they're reeling from the fact that this is higher cost from them, but GAB is saying that they're not passing this on to the consumers because we are going through some hard times. We're going through some kind of economic slowdown.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, the MD of Guinness Anker Burkhardt argues that it makes no sense to commercialize the increase in product, and they say that they will lose demand if they do so. So I guess this begs a bigger question. In the sin industry, both tobacco and also alcohol, is it the interest of the government to reduce the consumption of mass markets consuming these products, or is it the objective of the government to raise revenue from this sector? My argument is, if it does, if the government does want to raise revenue, then there will be some implications later on with regard to health, with regard to social issues. So it could be the very reason why the government wants to increase this excise duty, because they want the consumption to drop. The larger argument of companies within this sector, including companies like JTI, BAT, and now Guinness Anker Burkhardt, is that people will still consume this product even if it is not made legal. That means illicit cigarettes will be on the rise. That means bootleg alcohol will be on the rise as well. So I don't know where we need to have this resolution from this topic.
I mean, this when you say sin industry, Ibrahim, I'm thinking of an assembly line, you know, producing, stamping out sin, you know. And it's,
which is not far from the truth.
Well, right. I mean, you know, we all have our bad habits, including syrupy drinks. And, you know, if there's a public policy dimension to the way the government is taxing the breweries, can we discern something about that?
I think that this is where it gets very nuanced, because with the cigarettes, you want to reduce volumes and you do that by taxation. And at the same time, the byproduct of that is to raise revenues for the government. So obviously, the discussion about illicit cigarettes is something else, right? Our government is losing revenue from that. But with beers and with wine, there's supposedly health benefits. So this is not so much about reducing your consumption of wine, but this is about raising revenues from, let's say, a product like wine. So it's very different. And with the wines and with your single malt whiskies, for which these are taxed, it's also about taxing the rich rather than the poor, right? Because cigarettes are mass products, where and beers are mass products, whereas wines and whiskies are premium products.
Well, I also believe that, you know, that there's evidence that a glass of wine a day is probably very good for you, as is. So it's a question of moderation, and shouldn't individuals be allowed to make those choices? And maybe educating people about abusing or becoming about addiction.
Well, it depends on whether you want your tax system to be progressive, because you're rich enough to buy a bottle of wine, should you be taxed more from that in spite of the health benefits of wine, right? So in this case, the excise duty on beers, which is a mass product, although the health benefits of beer is doubted, is still taxing the poor rather than rich, right? Beers are a lot more mass than wines are.
That's right.
Right. Moving on, Air Asia Berhad once again is trying to fend off speculation that it intends to go the privatization route.
Yeah, this has been going on. China Everbright, a Chinese company, was cited as being roped in to help Tony Fernandez privatize AirAsia, but he is coming out on record to deny that. I guess it's too expensive to privatize, because the unowned portion of AirAsia will cost between 4 to 5 billion, not to mention the books carry about 10 billion ringgit in debts. So in total, we're talking about the enterprise value of AirAsia. It will be about 15 billion to take on.
Why do companies go private? I mean, why do they take their companies off the stock
because
market?
The shareholders believe that the company is trading way below market value, and therefore they want to buy it on the cheap with the hope of listing them a few years later at a much higher price. They're trying to make money out of that.
I guess the question is why these rumors persist, right?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.